Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. How do establishment media outlets frame and curate our reality? How prevalent is propaganda and censorship in the U.S. today? Well, on today's Project Censored Show, we'll find out as we welcome back two leading media studies scholars and journalists, Alan McLeod and Robin Anderson. An hour of talking about propaganda in the information age and how corporate media are still manufacturing consent. Stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program for this segment, we welcome back to the program the independent journalist and media scholar, Alan McLeod. He is a staff writer for Mint Press News, and after completing his PhD in 2017, he published two books, Bad News from Venezuela, 20 Years of Fake News and Misreporting, and Propaganda in the Information Age, Still Manufacturing Consent, a title riffing off of Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky's book from 1988 that outlines something called the propaganda model for news. Alan McLeod has also contributed to Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, The Guardian, Salon, The Gray Zone, Common Dreams, and many, many other publications, and has, of course, been featured here on the Project Censored Show before and has contributed articles to Project Censored. Alan McLeod, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
It's good to be back with you, Mickey.
You have been quite prolific of late with your journalism, publishing both at Mint Press and Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, among other places. What are some of your views right now about what's going on in terms of global media, either with the U.S. and in the U.K., as far as flap of fake news and propaganda coming from all sides?
The term fake news, we tend to associate it with small-time Macedonian bloggers on Tumblr or Facebook or something, or, you know, memes shared by Trump-loving moms in Kansas. But if we actually think about what fake news is, it's the idea of intentionally publishing stories meant to deceive the population. The reality is that the most dangerous and most harmful false reporting almost always comes from the largest outlets. So if you think about the biggest fake news story, arguably of the 21st century, which was the weapons of mass destruction lie, was that being pushed by small outlets on the internet? No, it was the CNNs, the New York Times, the Washington Post of the world. And that ultimately led to millions of people dying or having their lives destroyed, an entire region of the world completely shattered, and multiple conflicts which still go on to this day. So I think generally when you talk about fake news, we have to start really casting our net a bit wider than just these sort of powerless people who might get a few thousand likes on Facebook or something. I think the problem is much deeper.
Alan McLeod, I agree with that assessment. And of course, my colleague and friend Nolan Higdon, his new book on the anatomy of fake news, really goes into detail about a history of what you just discussed going back for quite some time. But it's an interesting thing that even in academia, there's this confusion or allergy about writing about, quote, fake news and the idea that that's a Trump term. It's a term that President Trump uses, and it's something that's associated with places like QAnon or Breitbart or Reddit. And so there's this idea that we can't use the terminology, but the real problem is fake news is disinformation and propaganda, and that problem has been going on for centuries. Ramped up extraordinarily in the 20th century from the days of Eddie Bernays forward. And you mentioned weapons of mass destruction, or weapons of mass deception, as they were referred to from the Center for Media Democracy, John Stauber's work from years ago. What lessons do you take from that, both inside the academy or in so-called mainstream or establishment journalists having an allergy to this term? Do you see it all as a connection of their inability to aim their own critical lens on their own institutions?
If you've got long memories, you might actually remember that fake news was really popularized for about a week by the Hillary Clinton campaign until Trump turned it around on them immediately and said, you're fake news, CNN, you're fake news. And suddenly that very succinct thing just took off in the American public's imagination. And suddenly it's been linked with Trump. It really blew up in Clinton's face. There are similar stories. Trump has started to use phrases like the deep state has become a very politicized word where it actually it does describe a very real thing. But unfortunately, it's now almost only used by a certain group of people, and it's kind of undermined the term. In general, real journalism is printing stuff that powerful people don't want you to read, and everything else is just PR. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people in the big media outlets have a sort of allergy towards questioning power, partly because the people who own and control and pay their wages are those powerful people. They are business owners. They work for multi-billion dollar news organizations, the owners of which also have fingers in many pies. The classic example is the Washington Post being owned by the world's richest man, Jeff Bezos. How are you going to accurately criticize and scrutinize the powerful when arguably the most powerful, richest man in the world is your boss? That just doesn't really cut it. And that's the real problem right now with corporate media, as these corporations are getting bigger and bigger. And that's really, for me, the fundamental critical problem of our era and of our society. It's the power of these corporations.
Alan McLeod, I'm glad that you brought up the issue of Hillary Clinton's campaign and the accusations of fake news, and that was connected to, as you mentioned earlier, the Macedonian teenagers and Russian Putin propaganda and bots. And there was a lot of hay made of this, although, of course, we've subsequently did a lot of analysis on this, including a chapter in our last book by Emil Marmel and Lee Major about this whole idea of fake news was brought up and weaponized in a lot of ways, and then co-opted, and then Trump took it off leash. But it was Clinton and the Washington Post that were propounding it for a while, and then Margaret Sullivan, the media critic of the Washington Post, once this started to get off leash, she said, it's time to retire the term. I had always said, well, yeah, I'm tired of hearing the term too, but why don't we retire the practice? And then maybe we won't need such a term. So in your writing, and I know you've written about your own episodes of censorship, you've experienced exactly what you've just described about this top-down managed news propaganda system, where I know you've had your own challenges getting things published at major or establishment institutions. Does an example or two spring to mind?
I was asked to write about Venezuela, for instance, when there was pretty much a coup going on, when Juan Guaido declared himself the president of the country. And I wrote something that got a lot of traction in alternative media. And then a couple of people from liberal outlets in both the United Kingdom and the United States, they both independently got in touch with me. They both came out and said, we'd love to work with you. This would be a really good opportunity. I think what you wrote there really needs to be seen by a lot more people. And in the end, I went with the American one. And I wrote the article, and then he started saying, well, I don't think you can really use those sorts of terms. Oh, that's not a good idea, putting that out. My boss won't take that. And then he was like, could you find different sources for this? Because they absolutely will not allow RT to be used as a link. You can't link to Russian media anymore. The article was actually about how top-down censorship of media organizations affects the output of these organizations. And so in the end, you know, I did work with him. He made a lot of changes, which made the piece a lot more, I would say, mundane and bland than I would have it. But he was certainly on my side, so I decided to keep going. Anyway, he said, right, great, this is going to go out tomorrow. All I need to do is get the okay from higher ups. And then the next day I got an email saying the higher ups have killed this. They hated the idea. They've come back with a list of 15 things that you have to do to change it. And the list was just absurd. She was wanting me to put in all of these sorts of completely non-factual things that appear in Western media outlets, representation of Latin America and of Venezuela in particular. I was like, I cannot put that in because that's just factually incorrect. My credibility was shot. And so in the end, the article was completely ditched and I ended up printing it in Venezuela Analysis. And that was like probably my most read article that I've had in years, actually. So it showed that there was a huge appetite for it. But interestingly enough, I was actually writing about the propaganda model and how that affects media coverage of Venezuela. And the people who I was working with actually said, do you think this experience has strengthened your ideas about the propaganda model? And I said, yes, absolutely.
It's an example made in real time. And in fact, you co-authored a piece that ended up at Project Censored, the most important article you'll never read, how Western media supports state terror while millions die, and how this article was killed. That was back in 2019. Alan McLeod. So definitely something that you have, I guess, ironic experience about, given that you study this issue and then you were embroiled in the middle of it. And we see it particularly around those areas. Stories about Venezuela, stories about Saudi Arabia. And you mentioned earlier the sullying of terms from fake news to the deep state, which makes it harder to talk about these controversial issues, even though there's a long line of scholarship going back from Peter Dale Scott, David Talbot. Even at PBS, Bill Moyers did a secret government special in 1987 on Iran-Contra that focused on the CIA's secret wars. I don't think you'd see that at PBS these days. But it makes it difficult to talk about those stories. But you have long covered these things. And of course, also another one of those third rail topics is any kind of criticism of Israel vis-a-vis Gaza. One of your recent pieces, by the way, then, from Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, was titled "Media Show Little Interest in Israeli Bombing of Gaza." Could you talk a little bit about that and, again, how that fits into the propaganda model?
As we're speaking, it's been, I think, 2 weeks of continuous bombing of Gaza by the Israeli Air Force. You would think that that sort of thing would get a lot of coverage because Western media outlets have a lot of correspondents in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv. This is a major story in the Middle East, of course. And yet, when I tried to find a bit more information about it, I searched NBC, CNN, MSNBC, PBS, Fox News. None of those outlets had even mentioned it. And across the mainstream spectrum, there was virtually only a couple of mentions. CBS and ABC did have a couple of articles which they copied and pasted from a newswire. But those outlets typically repeated the exact same structure of how Israeli aggression against its enemies is always presented, which is Israel is responding to a threat from its neighbors. It's never Israel doing the aggression here, even though the country invaded Palestine in 1967 and hasn't left. It's almost functionally impossible for Israel to be the aggressor. My supervisor at the Glasgow Media Group did a long study in the 2000s and then again in 2010, and he showed that that sort of framing actually changes the way people perceive the conflict, and they always see Israel as being this besieged democracy rather than an aggressive nation. And in fact, there was a pro-Israel document circulated by a group called, I think, the Israel Project, which is an Israeli-American group which talks to journalists and pro-Israel activists and advocates and tells them what sort of words, what sort of phrases, how to frame discussions to best suit the government of Israel. And he found that the exact same words and phrases that were being used in this document are still to this day being used by corporate press from Western countries that have pretty much nothing to do with Israel. So they're essentially doing the bidding of the Israeli government, even if they're not meaning to, because that's just become the convention.
So Alan McLeod, another one of these stories, you mentioned Israel vis-a-vis Palestine, and another story that you have been writing about very recently. In the UK in particular, a British soldier was arrested for opposing the UK's arming of Saudi Arabia connected to their war against Yemen. Can you talk about how that's another example of another subject that either falls through the cracks, gets dumped in the memory hole, or becomes part of only a one-sided propaganda campaign?
With Yemen, Saudi Arabia is the one doing the aggression. Again, that's a key ally of the West. It's been called the worst humanitarian crisis in the world by the United Nations, where something like 24 million people are in dire need of humanitarian assistance. There's over 20 million people who lack drinkable water, which has created a catastrophe. The twin crises of COVID-19 and 19th century diseases like cholera have even returned in Yemen. But again, the media is really not talking about this too much. A Yemeni-born British soldier, however, has decided to take it upon himself and said that he will simply refuse to serve in the British Army until Britain ends its support for Saudi Arabia. A lot of people in the UK would say, how are we supporting Saudi Arabia? But in fact, the UK is one of the Saudi government's key allies. It has 200 troops in the country, which perform key services like training Saudi troops and refueling and repairing these very costly jets, which need highly technical expertise to do so. The country also sells billions of pounds worth of military equipment to Saudi Arabia, some of which even the Americans refuse to sell them. The UK's arms exports are pretty large, but 49% of them go to Saudi Arabia and only 51% to all the other countries in the world. Although a lot of Saudi's key allies in the onslaught against Yemen, Kuwait and Qatar are also pretty high on that list. And so the UK government and big defence contractors in the West are cashing in on the suffering of the Yemeni people. And this should be a much larger story, because our governments could, in fact, pretty much limit the damage and almost end the conflict overnight if they withdrew support. In fact, they might not even have to withdraw support. They could just say, we're not going to sell you any more arms. And that would have a huge impact, a massive positive impact on the situation in Yemen. But unfortunately, we're not talking about that. We're talking about imagined or very small transgressions from Russia or China against us. And those become the front page things. And things like Yemen get relegated to, if they're lucky, page 36 or a couple minute segment every few months.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are speaking with independent journalist and media scholar Alan McLeod. He is a staff writer for Mint Press News, also publishes with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting and many, many other outlets. After this brief musical break, we're going to continue our conversation about media and propaganda. Propaganda in the Information Age, in fact, a title of one of Alan McLeod's books. So stay with us.
Today I was crying, lost in a lost world. So many people are dying, lost in a lost world. Some of them are living an illusion, bounded by the darkness of their minds. In their eyes it's nation against nation.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's show, in this segment of the program, we're speaking with independent journalist Alan McLeod. He is also a media scholar, finished his PhD in 2017. He has published two books, one, Bad News from Venezuela, 20 Years of Fake News and Misreporting, and the other, Propaganda in the Information Age, Still Manufacturing Consent. And certainly those have been themes we're riffing on here today on the Project Censored Show. Alan McLeod, prolifically writing and publishing these days, specifically at Mint Press News and at FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. So if you want to see Alan McLeod's articles, go to mintpressnews.com or go to fair.org, F-A-I-R. You're based in the UK, but you've written about many things happening in the United States, and they're all very timely. So I wanted to continue our survey here, and specifically under the frame of the propaganda model, and how these kind of topics are either not being reported much at all, or if they are, they're written about in a distorted or skewed context. One of those issues, if you want to tackle this, I wanted to talk about the U.S. election, the Republican candidate, current President Donald Trump, with Vice President Mike Pence, and the Democratic candidate, former Senator and Vice President Joe Biden, with Kamala Harris, who was Attorney General and a Senator from California. You know, the conventions that took place, you wrote about the carefully choreographed convention and how progressive policies were not at all central to Biden's bid. And you wrote about these key messages and media coverage of this.
Obviously, in the earlier part of this year, there was the big battle between Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden to decide the near future of the Democratic Party. Would it take a more social democratic leftist trajectory with Sanders, or the more right wing traditional neoliberal standard democratic position with Biden? And Biden in the end won, where pretty much all the non-Sanders candidates pulled out, coordinated, and endorsed Biden, which got him over the line. I think naturally Biden's quite a sort of conservative guy. He likes to converse and hang out with Republicans. He got his start in politics by opposing busing during the civil rights era. He did the eulogy at Strom Thurmond's funeral, the notorious segregationist. So he's always had this affinity for Republicans, and he's tended to have a strong disinterest in anything too left. His first campaign stop was a big dinner with wealthy donors, and he said nothing would fundamentally change if I was the president. Because of this big left wave, he's been forced to sort of adopt quite a lot of very progressive positions in his platform, like, for instance, a $15 minimum wage, And that's clearly been pushed on him from the Sanders wing of the party. But it seems pretty clear that he's not personally particularly interested in that. And that, we kind of saw that at the Democratic convention, where a lot of the speakers tended to actually be Republicans rather than progressives. So somebody like AOC got 1 minute to talk, but then there was just a host of lifelong Republicans like John Kasich, who Trump asked to become his vice president, for instance, was speaking. He was almost the guest of honor at the convention, you know? And it was a lot of positive talk about ideals and progress at the DNC convention, but not very much about concrete proposals. And I think that was a deliberate decision, because the Democratic higher-ups and the team around Biden don't really want to talk policy, because ultimately, I don't think they're offering America something that's radically different from what Donald Trump is offering. I mean, sure, he might not be quite as aggressive towards the LGBT community. He might not recklessly try to destroy the environment like Trump has. But ultimately, Biden is not really offering ordinary Americans that much in terms of, say, Medicare for all or a Green New Deal, for instance. And so he can't really go to ordinary people and say, this is what I stand for, this is what I'm going to give you. So it has to be more about opposing Trump. And, you know, that actually may well get him over the line, because, you know, not being Trump is a pretty good, strong arguing point.
It's not invigorating to the electorate. And certainly we saw record numbers of people coming out in support of more progressive policies, whether they were Sanders, AOC, the so-called squad, and others. It seems as though there's a type of tone deafness at the DNC level, whereby they have Biden from the crime bill to Kamala Harris, the top cop. During this mass uprising of Black Lives Matter, police violence, I mean, you see what's happening here just even recently in Wisconsin. Of course you have. You wrote about what was happening in Wisconsin and how the police were basically put on paid leave for this. Juxtapose those kind of issues for us. You just wrote about what was happening in Wisconsin with the young person who shot protesters there versus the kind of message that we're getting from the DNC, kind of like law and order light, if it's even light at all compared to the Republicans.
The writer of the crime bill and California's top cop are the Democratic choice during the era of Black Lives Matter and prison reform. It seems absolutely crazy. The guy who stood against Medicare for all for his life is now still sticking to his guns during a terrible pandemic where millions of people have lost their health care overnight. It seems absolutely crazy. And, you know, it's really a sign of where the Republican Party and President Trump in particular is, that despite all of that, he might actually be elected. I mean, polls show that he's still there. But ultimately, you know, we see Democrats saying, you know, the solution to police violence and all of this is to vote. But the reality is that George Floyd was killed in a deeply blue state with a blue mayor, a blue governor, blue senators, and that still happened. That was under a Democratic administration, really, even though Trump is president. And the same thing can be said with things like, you know, ICE murders or the treatment of immigrants. Although Donald Trump is obviously absolutely obscene in the way he treats immigrants, ultimately, Biden as vice president was signing on to all sorts of bills that Obama put through.
So, Alan McLeod, at a time when we have Black Lives Matter and we have a lot of talk about police reform and defunding or reallocating police monies and prison reform, the Democratic Party is offering up a candidate who was behind the crime bill, and also Kamala Harris, who is seen by many as top cop in California with her record there. There seems to be a kind of a tone deafness in the DNC leadership about what's happening in the country right now.
Biden and Harris's records on issues to do with Black people, people of color, in terms of mass incarceration or segregation or racist policing is absolutely terrible. And their solution, most of the sort of pop Democrats are saying, you know, the solution to Trump and all of the problems you see, whether it's racial justice or state violence, is to vote. But the problem is that the George Floyd protest started in Minneapolis. And George Floyd was killed by an officer in a blue state with a blue governor, blue senators, blue state prosecutor, and a blue mayor. And yet, that still happened there. It wasn't like Donald Trump was personally orchestrating that. And that's the real problem here. Neither Democrats nor Republicans are particularly interested in appealing to working class ordinary Americans because they don't really want ordinary Americans to vote. Neither of them seem to be particularly interested in representing the large majority of the Americans. The money that comes into their coffers comes from the top 1%. It comes from big businesses, from big PACs, from wealthy donors. It doesn't come from Starbucks employees or hotel maids or taxi drivers like it did with people like Bernie Sanders. And so they're not really interested in representing those people because that's just not who they serve. And that's the real problem right now. We've got one party with two different wings, and you can choose the blue flavor or the red flavor. It's kind of like a good cop, bad cop thing. But no matter who you vote for, you're still going to get a representative of Wall Street or Silicon Valley or Big Oil or whatever in the White House in November, whether it's Biden or Trump. Certainly, there are very big differences that can be said between the two, and I think it is worth voting for one over the other. But ultimately, we shouldn't delude ourselves into thinking that, you know, one of them is really our friend.
Well, Alan McLeod, we have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to touch on one more issue. Happens to relate around the election, certainly something we see with political party propaganda as well as in the corporate press, and that is particularly at least among Democrats and a lot of the corporate media, MSNBC, CNN, The Washington Post, The New York Times, the canard that is Russiagate that continues. More recently, we saw the story about alleged bounties in Afghanistan, and also we've seen a resurrection of the Senate report that didn't really seem to go anywhere during the impeachment process. So, Alan McLeod, could you talk to us about the enduring propaganda around Russiagate?
Sometimes I think we're stuck in some kind of time loop, that we're going back to 2016 again, and we're talking about birtherism to do with Kamala Harris and Russiagate to do with the 2020 elections as well. We're just stuck repeating the 2010s over and over again. This story I thought would die, but yeah, the New York Times in June reported that Russia had been paying Taliban fighters bounties to kill US soldiers. And this was immediately picked up by virtually every other outlet, from the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, MSNBC, pretty much the entire media landscape was talking about it. I was amazed at the flimsiness of the allegations. To start with, it was based on anonymous sources who openly admitted that they were intelligence officials. And as I said in the piece that you're referring to, pretty much the only people less credible, if you're a journalist, than government spies are anonymous government spies. And yet this was taken up and just run with for weeks by not only the New York Times, but virtually the entire media, who didn't question these people who have clearly got an incentive to lie to journalists. In fact, that's pretty much their job description, to plant misinformation and wage an information war against their enemies. And there was an even more bizarre one where Business Insider apparently said that they'd actually increased this specter by interviewing some Taliban fighters who confirmed this. But in the piece, they actually admitted that one of their sources was somebody on Facebook who they'd never met. They didn't even know his name, and they were just typing at them. And the idea that this could become like a major story, which is now stop the United States actually pulling out of Afghanistan like it was meant to do, like Trump has always said he was going to do but never does. The fact that this was able to happen is really a bizarre and worrying thing that's happening in the media. We're just planning a couple of fake news stories or highly questionable news stories changes the course of U.S. military history in the Middle East.
Alan McLeod, that was from your piece in Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting from July. In Russian bounty story, evidence-free claims from nameless spies become fact overnight. Alan McLeod, you wrote that for Fair back in July. And of course, that comes round full circle to where we began our conversation about the propaganda model, the continued efforts to control narratives, certainly something you have written a lot about, including in one of your books, Propaganda in the Information Age, Still Manufacturing Consent. By the look of your impeccable reporting, the corporate media still is manufacturing consent, and we've got a lot of work to do to deconstruct it. And Alan McLeod, you certainly help your readers do that. So I wanted to thank you for your intrepid independent reporting, both with Mint Press News, with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, and the many other outlets you've worked with. And also just thank you for taking time to rejoin us today on the Project Censored show.
Well, thanks for those kind words. That means a lot coming from somebody who's done so much for media literacy in the last few decades.
Well, it's good to work on those issues together. As we both know, it's a daunting task, and I would at least argue that it's probably one of the most central areas that we need to focus on. So again, Alan McLeod, thanks so much for joining us on the Project Censored show.
Good to be with you.
Up next on the Project Censored show, we welcome back media scholar Robin Anderson to continue our conversation about media and current events. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we are delighted to bring back Professor Robin Anderson. Robin Anderson is an author, professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University. She has written dozens of book chapters and journal articles, and she serves as a Project Censored judge. Her book, A Century of Media, A Century of War, won the Alpha Sigma Nu Book Award in 2007. And Robin Anderson is currently co-editor of the Rutledge Focus Book Series on Media and Humanitarian Action. Her latest book is Media, Central American Refugees, and the U.S. Border Crisis. Robin Anderson writes media criticism for fairness and accuracy in reporting, Common Dreams, and other publications, including Project Censored. Robin Anderson, welcome back to the Project Censored show.
Thanks, Mickey.
It is always good to have you on and to hear your critical media analysis of what's happening in the world around us in this very media-mediated world and media-saturated world. And we are here on the heels of the Democratic and Republican conventions. And of course, you have been writing a bit about this. One of your more recent pieces was actually about the DNC, or the Democratic National Committee, and the choice of the vice presidential candidate, Kamala Harris, the senator from California. Robin Anderson, your recent piece, Not All Criticism of Kamala Harris is Created Equal for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, echoes back to the 2016 election, and there was criticism of the criticism about the Hillary Clinton campaign, such that, you know, it was difficult to see criticism often coming from the left about policy because it would often be conflated with gender dynamics, with sexism, misogyny. There are very misogynistic and sexist critiques of women politicians, including Hillary Clinton, including Kamala Harris. Talk to us a little bit about this article and what prompted you to write this.
They've been, as you point out, lumping together the racist and sexist criticism of Kamala Harris, some harking back to 2016, with legitimate evaluations of the trajectory of her political policies. For example, speaking of 2016, the old saw that nobody likes her was raised by Tucker Carlson, of course, right away. And then, of course, the purveyor of hate that occupies the White House wheeled out, oh, she's nasty, nasty four times, and then extraordinarily nasty because of the way she questioned Brett Kavanaugh. Also, that she changes her mind, trying to imply the idea that she's not trustworthy. And, of course, women in general are not trustworthy because they change their minds. Or questioning her citizenship, which is what Newsweek did.
Yeah, that was remarkable. And that, of course, harkens back to birtherism. Kamala Harris was attorney general here and does have a past that has drawn some controversy.
One of the big problems that she opens herself up to scrutiny is that she has always said that she's a progressive prosecutor. And then she proceeded throughout her career up until 2004 and then after to criminalize inner city neighborhoods, be excessively punitive, and increase the incarceration rate of African Americans in low-income communities. So that's one of her main problems. Now, she has kind of flip-flopped, really, in terms of how she speaks and what she actually does. One of the articles that was referred to as an illustration of how she changes her mind that I found was actually a Reuters piece. And it was done in a derogatory fashion, and the media is just saying, oh, she's untrustworthy, she changes her mind. Well, the Reuters piece was actually a genuine and authentic look at how she has tried to find a political persona, particularly when she was one of the Democratic candidates for president. She came out early on and said that she was for Medicare for all, and she adopted some of the progressive policies. Pretty soon, however, she moved over to the center. Probably one of the reasons I think that she ultimately had to drop out of the campaign was she didn't find a space. She's always been on this centrist borderline between trying to get progressive, but then kind of coming back to the center. And that was really illustrated when she was the Attorney General in California, when she came out strong against the death penalty. And then the momentum in California when a police officer was shot and the police came really down on her, she said, I'm going to rethink this death penalty thing.
So Kamala Harris then does what many of the Democratic candidates seem to do, polling and focus groups, and seems that if someone really wants to get to the center-center-right nomination, where the candidates seem to be in more neoliberal fashion, even if Harris did change her mind about certain things, it seems like that's some cardinal sin in American politics, the changing of one's mind.
That's really the key question. Does the candidate listen to what the constituency wants and therefore change their mind? Or do they finally have a movement behind them where they may be able to stand up to the courage of their own convictions? We might have seen that, Mickey, and I'm kind of hopeful that with her, after the killing of George Floyd, in the Senate, she and Cory Booker put through a police reform bill that was much more progressive than what the Republicans had put through. And Kamala Harris also went into the streets to demonstrate in Washington. There's so many problems with the criminal justice system at the moment and this kind of flashpoint that is Kamala Harris and the larger discussion that we really need to get into about police unions and the long history of them siding with businesses and then the war on drugs, and now really a huge portion of them are into this white supremacy stuff. These are this long, broad context of historical movements and issues that simply seem to be outside of the purview of most establishment media. We can't seem to get above this simple campaign-type discourse. Having said that, however, Kamala Harris came out and she said that she was in favor of protests, and she mentioned the names of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and she said, I'm in favor of them protesting because this kind of injustice has gone on for too long. And I think that was a very important moment in this admittedly slanted discourse of protesters and criminal justice issues with the fear being brought up by the Republicans, that she said that. And she, you know, in this new position as the vice presidential candidate, can actually come out and give voice to something that Joe Biden has been in the background and on the sideline for so long, not coming out and saying anything.
Well, Robin Anderson, you also point out in the FAIR article, looking at the more fact-based, policy-based kind of critiques of Harris. And for Harris to actually run or even remotely identify as progressive does become a little more questionable when you look at the record. You cite human rights attorney Marjorie Cohn, who talks about Harris's refusal to allow DNA testing for innocent death row inmate, her opposition to legislation requiring the Attorney General's office to independently investigate police shootings. Let's not forget that Kamala Harris didn't go after Steve Mnuchin, the so-called foreclosure king. So for people who pay attention, particularly on the left, Harris is certainly no progressive. And that's something that shouldn't be lumped in my view, with other more low-brow ad hominems that we talked about earlier.
there's this real interesting contradiction between the very progressive women of color who are behind her that Joan Walsh pointed out in the pages of The Nation that worked hard to get her chosen for this position as a woman of color and as somebody who could hopefully carry out a strong progressive female agenda, possibly. The biggest problem I see with her really connecting to the movement as it has developed with Black Lives Matter since 2015 is that the three main organizers are women of color. Two of them are trans women that started the leadership for the Black Lives Matter and the protests against police brutality and racism against the Black community. And she has particularly a bad reputation and a bad policy foundation for how she treats trans people. She put them into the main male prison population. She refused to give them medication, saying really awful things in court, like they need to have some therapy and their demands are frivolous. And if you think about the violence done against the Black community, trans women, Black trans women are targets. They're just targets. Many of them are afraid to go outside. And they are the victims of white supremacy violence all the time. So that may be the biggest thing that needs to be worked on to bring her possibly into an agenda that could be effective in any kind of deep structural way to alter what we're seeing in the streets of Kenosha after Jacob Blake was shot. And then you get a 17-year-old with a rifle killing two demonstrators. And this is the Republican agenda, and this is what Trump continue to promote: fear of Black people, fear of the demonstrations in the cities. They're going to come and get you in the suburbs.
We're speaking with Robin Anderson, professor of media studies and communications at Fordham University. Project Censored has been covering underreported and censored stories about the trans population, trans community for a number of years, including this year. As we mentioned earlier, in terms of the establishment frame, so many stories aren't there. They're not where most Americans seem to go to get news and information. I'd like to remind listeners you're tuned to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We are speaking with media scholar Robin Anderson. We were just discussing a recent article that she penned for FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Not all criticism of Kamala Harris is created equal. And right near the end of this last segment here, Robin, you helped us segue over to the Republican convention and the sort of triumph of the swill that was happening there. So after this brief musical break, we will continue our conversation. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we've been talking about media and media criticism of the many issues that are going on around us in our society today. Earlier, we spoke with Alan McLeod, and right now, we welcome back to the program Robin Anderson, author and professor of communication and media studies at Fordham University, has written dozens of book chapters and journal articles. She serves as a Project Censored judge as well, looking at our underreported stories every year. Robin Anderson regularly writes for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, Common Dreams, and also Project Censored as a media critic. So, Robin Anderson, you gave us a lot to think about in the first segment here of our conversation. At the end there, you started to talk more about a very different narrative that we're hearing coming out of the Republican convention, many of the speakers there, this rampant faux nationalism, xenophobia. There's a lot of phobias of various stripes. It seemed like it was running on fear.
Gosh, the Republican convention. We can't think about it any other way than the total triumph of propaganda. Absolute discounting of any kind of reality. Trump said that he's the best leader and has been the best leader. And at the same time, we've got almost 6 million Americans that have come down with COVID and 183,000 people dead, absolutely ignoring the facts of COVID. And then promoting the most rank kind of conspiracy theory of QAnon, which is supposed to be a high-up government official of the deep state that's giving a lot of information for this conspiracy theory against the Democrats, many of them who are child abusers, and Trump is the only one battling these people. And along with that, the optics of that convention to really put him outside of a political discourse, but above in this kind of savior, which is part of this Trump cult, and that's really all they've got going for them right now in the middle of environmental, economic, pandemic disasters raging around him. The optics of him standing in this whole built stage of the South Lawn with 1,500 people crammed together, none of them wearing masks, so that he could have an adoring crowd as a backdrop. And there's a few pictures of him with his arms out, with the seal of the U.S. president acting as a halo around his head with his arms out, as if he's the savior coming down from heaven with a halo. And it's real Leni Riefenstahl stuff in Triumph of the Will, where, of course, Hitler comes down out of the clouds. And it is just too visually strikingly similar for anybody who knows any of this history.
Let's say it, it's a spectacle. Despite the Hatch Act saying that public officials aren't supposed to be using places like the White House as a backdrop, apparently the Hatch Act somehow exempts, at least according to the folks over at Fox, the argument is going that presidents and vice presidents are kind of exempt from some of this, even though it seems to be igniting, I don't know if it's going to turn into an ethics probe, but certainly concerns have been raised. Look, to be fair, Democratic presidents have also done some of these types of things. I wouldn't say gone as far as what we're seeing now. In fact, Robin Anderson, you were very critical of media coverage after 9/11 of the run-ups to these various wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Kind of harkens back to the use of the USS Abraham Lincoln as a prop for George W. Bush, with that Top Gun fly-in and the whole way that they staged this whole sort of triumphant landing there to declare the war over, the one that we're still in, by the way. That's almost a 20-year window there. It seems to me that we've just seen even more and more ratcheting up by media of these kinds of frames.
The only way you can do this is to have a discourse that's so detached from reality and actually detached from a human perspective that you whip people up into this, as you mentioned before, Mickey, a faux patriotism. They're actually making people be afraid of a conspiracy theory and the idea that they're going to take their guns away and the people in the suburbs will somehow be the victims of inner city people. You know, as that coach, Doc Rivers, teared up after Blake was shot, and he said, "Fear of us," this dignified black man saying, "Why do they keep talking about fear of us? We're the ones who are being killed." It's such a turnaround of reality. One of the things that I also find problematic about remaining in this abstracted discourse for a presidential election campaign is, if you notice Kamala Harris, which we mentioned before, talking about Trump's failure for the COVID policies, she goes back to January and you know, let's remember each and every step that Trump took that made us more vulnerable, that he ignored and denied something just because he wanted his campaign to win and he was afraid of the economy and all that stuff. But what is missing in all of this is, we already mentioned a historical context for all this stuff, but really a human perspective. When we talk about COVID-19, we're talking about 183,000 Americans who have largely had to die without their loved ones around them, where people are being evicted. All of the consequences. There was a fellow on CNN after the Republican convention and after Trump's speech where he was flipping through 20 falsehoods that that the president had said where he's created 9 million jobs, but there's 23 million that people have lost. We can't seem to get that into a human context which seeks to understand how it actually affects people's lives, how your neighbor can die, how somebody on Fox News can say, oh, we're all going to get this virus eventually. That's why it's fine for 1,500 people to be on the South Lawn. It's such a strange detachment from humanity and from the ways in which the world actually works. That's what I just think is hard to digest from a media critic's perspective.
When you talk about the detachment, that, in my view, the detachment really allows and gives cover for increased cynicism. And Tucker Carlson the other day, before anybody knows all of the details of anything, is saying that the 17-year-old with the rifle was defending himself and protesters deserve to be shot. You just mentioned the fear of African Americans and they're coming to the suburbs. I mean, is this the 1950s? Is this Levittown? Is this redlining again? Harkening back to Emmett Till? Is it the 70s? Yeah. Is this Richard Nixon? Is this Kent State, the National Guard? Is this the law and order and the bums on the streets? These tropes go way back in our history, but they're recycled, as you mentioned, ahistorically. They're recycled out of context as if there's nothing to see here. All there is on the surface, right, of the spectacle, and there's no invitation by the media, by journalists in the corporate establishment. Let's be very clear there. There isn't really much probing as to what the impact of this kind of messaging is on the population.
There's a huge historical void there. And if we think about the history, that's really being examined by the alternative press in these Times, Consortium News. They're doing an admirable job. In the streets, journalists are now being attacked by the police.
This is something else. We did a show that touched on this a while ago. Since George Floyd, there's been a massive spike in incidents of violence involving journalists. And if you check out the Freedom of the Press Foundation, Freedom Tracker, Trevor Tim and Ryan Rice wrote just in late August, here it is, across 75 cities and 35 states, more than 700 incidents are being investigated. 84% are reported to have been acts of violence perpetrated by law enforcement against journalists. And then they go on to write, even when removing the 100 arrests and detainments of journalists, we're left with the police allegedly being involved 82% of the time in over 700 incidents of violence against journalists. That's just against journalists.
We know that the quote-unquote violence is happening because of police provocation primarily, or provocative agents like the white supremacist who battered out the window in, you know, one of the cities in major protests. So the fact that they're really against bearing witness and documentation of the events in the street underscores the fact that they know if there's fair coverage that the people are gonna see things for what they are, as police brutality. And now the rubric, and actually I think Kamala Harris actually said that she doesn't agree with destruction of property. The idea that private property has now come into this debate, the fact that Kamala Harris has to say, I'm in favor of protesters, shows you how far to the right the debate has gone, because our country is based on our freedom of expression and gathering. That's fundamentally American. And now when you have to actually say you're in favor of that primary American thing instead of having a more sophisticated argument is a problem in itself.
And notice that these are all ensconced in the First Amendment, the assembly, the right to petition, right, government, free press. That's all right there in the beginning. And what we seem to see here, too, is the narrative of shooting the messenger, whether the messenger is a disgruntled protester in the street, whether the messenger is people of color being victims of violence at the hands of police, and increasingly record numbers of journalists. Do you see this changing as we move through fall? And I don't want to maintain a cynical posture here, but on the basis of what we've been seeing here this summer in 2020, it seems to portend toward more of this United States of distraction and chaos moving forward. Do you see a way out of this and around this?
I think people are tired of being in a system where the small minority at the top, those with wealth and power, simply do not represent what they need, their values, what they're in favor of. I mean, when you've got 87% of the people in favor of Medicare for all, and neither of the political parties are now promoting that, I think that the more that we, the people, put pressure on these officials, then something really will give. And I think we might have entered a turning point with the disgust that many white people feel and have actually stated that they are in favor of the people in the streets and protest. So on Friday, after the convention, was the 57th anniversary of the March on Washington, where Martin Luther King went to Washington. And that protest, people are wearing masks, they're getting their temperature taken. It's very based in reality, it's very based in unity and social responsibility. And it's another really powerful reassertion, and I think it will be another show of force for the will of the people. And I think that what we need to do is, going forward, and should the Biden-Harris ticket win, we'll have even more of our work cut out for us to push them to what the people actually need and want.
We've been speaking with media scholar Robin Anderson. You can read more of Robin Anderson's work at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, fair.org, also on Common Dreams. And Robin Anderson wrote a stellar chapter on news abuse propaganda for Project Censored this year that'll be out later in the fall, Seven Stories Press. Robin Anderson, thank you again for taking time to talk to us about these really important issues.
Oh, thank you, Mickey. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
Conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians.
You've been listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio, established in 2010 by myself and Peter Phillips. I'm Mickey Huff, the executive producer and host of the program. Our occasional co-host is Chase Palmieri. Anthony Fest is our longtime senior producer. Our associate producer is Dennis Murphy. The Project Censored Show airs on roughly 50 stations around the United States, from Maui to New York. To learn more about our work or find any of our previous archive programs, go to projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and be sure to subscribe to the official Project Censored Show on your cell phone's podcast application. Please feel free to share your feedback about our work at projectcensored.org. And last but not least, thanks to you, our listeners, for tuning in. Stay well. We'll see you next time.
Thinkable crimes perpetrated by the criminal minds, political ties, habitual eyes, alibis, disguise, another guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks on the bridges and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens, hypnotized by the master thief. Confine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential fame at the table, then you're probably on the menu.